Marshall, will you call the next case?
8191561,
Good morning, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you want to use it. I'll remind you, since we are recording these proceedings, to please introduce yourself when you come to the podium each time, and the podium does have a button so you can raise or lower it to fit your needs. So, counsel, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Chris Heinze. I'm here representing the appellant, Ms. Wendy Heinrichs-Cady. This is a case that raises relatively easy questions, however the answers to those questions are relatively complex. The facts of the case are clear due to the posture of this matter. This is an appeal from a motion to dismiss, and as such all facts in the complaint are deemed to be true. And these facts demonstrate that respondent Hennepin County retaliated and ultimately terminated Ms. Heinrichs-Cady because of her pregnancy. In other words, the county discriminated against Ms. Heinrichs-Cady because she was pregnant. She was discriminated against when Hennepin County summarily refused her request for reasonable accommodations, when Hennepin County refused to engage in an interactive process regarding her request for reasonable accommodations, when the county placed her on unpaid leave from her job immediately after Ms. Heinrichs-Cady requested the reasonable accommodations, and when the county terminated Ms. Heinrichs-Cady the morning she returned to work after giving birth to her son. To be clear, the reasonable accommodations that Ms. Heinrichs-Cady sought were increased breaks, not lifting heavy items. She requested not to drive while experiencing severe fatigue or dizziness, and to not put herself or her unborn baby in unsafe environments. She had 7 weeks left of her pregnancy, and she requested these accommodations for those last 7 weeks. So,
did not request leave.
Did not request leave, no, Your Honor. So now we return to the questions that presented to this court. And the first question is whether Ms. Heinrichs-Cady is protected against the kind of discriminatory action taken against her by Hennepin County. In other words, is the county prohibited under the law from discriminating against Ms. Heinrichs-Cady because of her pregnancy? And the answer, as it turns out, is relatively difficult. Start with Minnesota Statute 181.9414, which is entitled Pregnancy Accommodations. That statute was enacted as part of the Women's Economic Security Act. The Women's Economic Security Act was sweeping legislation, as you know, enacted a little more than 5 years ago, largely to protect women in the workplace. Now, 181.9414 in particular requires employers to provide reasonable accommodations to pregnant workers. It requires employers to engage in an interactive process with a pregnant employee who requests accommodation related to her pregnancy. It prohibits employers from requiring an employee to take an unpaid leave of absence, and it prohibits an employer from retaliating against an employee who requests accommodations. So, when you apply the law to the facts of the law of this case, it seems pretty clear. Hennepin County violated the statute as it regards Ms. Heinrichs-Cady. But the county says not so fast. They rely upon the definition section set forth in 181.940.
So if we're not going to look to that definition section, where do we look?
Well, I think you're on, it's problematic. I think what you need to look at is this is use the statutory interpretation rules that are set forth in 645.1.6.
And I understand you're saying because she didn't request a leave, that definition of employee doesn't apply to her. So where do we look?
Well, I think it's ambiguous. I think that's what it is. And so in determining the ambiguity, you look toward the statutory rules. Why the statute was enacted in the first place.
I think I'm asking a simpler question than that. I mean, you're going down the why this shouldn't apply, this definition of employee, which requires a certain amount of work. And I'm saying, well, if it's not that definition of employee, where do we look? Do we just say whoever Hennepin County has on their, you know, treats as an employee? Is that the definition, or is there some other statute you'd refer us to?
Sure, and that's the problem. The legislature wasn't as artful as we'd like them to be in saying who an employee was. And I think without, if that definition doesn't apply, then it's treated as any other undefined term that's within the statute, and it takes a plain meaning under the law.
To you, then, that would be who Hennepin County treats as an employee?
Sure. Anybody who is employed, who is a W-2 employee under the Internal Revenue Code would be an employee under the statute.
Like a dictionary definition.
Yeah, exactly. Just like the court would interpret any other plain meaning of any other word in a statute that wasn't otherwise defined.
What about if we look at subdivision 2, the definition?
Mm-hmm.
It says employee means a person and then who requests a leave. That's a disputed language, right? Whether that should apply to your client. It goes on to say employee includes all individuals employed at any site owned or operated by the employer. Does that potentially give a broader definition that would cover your employee's case?
I believe so, but I think it's, if I'm remembering correctly, the difference between or the connector between subsection 1 and 2 is an and, if I'm remembering correctly.
Oh no, there's a whole second sentence.
Okay.
So employee, if you have the definition in front of you, maybe not, is an person who performs services for hire for employer for whom leave is requested for, and then number 1, at least 12 months preceding request, number 2, and number 2, blah, blah. Then there's a whole nother sentence.
Yeah.
And this whole new sentence says, employee includes all individuals employed at any site owned or operated by the employer. I'm wondering how that sentence relates to, and then it goes on to say, but does not include an independent contractor, so it's excluding independent contractors. But I'm just wondering if that sentence gives some space. Because I mean, we'll talk about this with the county, there is a certain, the definition, when you look at the legislative history of this, the pregnancy accommodation part was added into a leave statute.
Yes.
Right? And the definition of an employee was with respect to leave because it only used to deal with leave.
Correct.
Presumably.
Before 9414, it worked just fine.
Right, because everything in that section dealt with leave. Now suddenly it's talking about employees and accommodate people who seek non-leave accommodations, but it defines employees with respect to leave. That's problematic,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
And so I'm looking at that last sentence, which might have preceded all of this too, but there's a lot in Chapter 181, actually, a lot of provisions that deal with employees that don't define it, employee. What we have here is a definition that doesn't work nicely with the facts of this case or the facts of a pregnant employee who doesn't seek leave.
Correct.
Right?
Right, correct. And I think the answer to your larger question is I do think that language gives you more width to find that that the appellant is an employee under 9414.
If I can take you to that, I'm sure you're probably turning to soon, the exclusivity argument.
Yes.
The county cited as supplemental authority the Miller versus Board of Regents case.
Yes.
Could you please address that about why we shouldn't also here hold under kind of a similar rationale that under Williams we really have to say that the Human Rights Act has exclusivity both with the Whistleblower Act, and if that's clear for the Whistleblower Act, why is the are the pregnancy accommodations different?
Sure, and thank you for the question, Your Honor. I think there is a distinction between this case and the Williams case and the unreported case that was just cited by the respondent. And I think here's the difference. When you compare Ms. Heinrichs Katie's claim under 9414 when compared to an MHRA claim, they do not involve identical elements of proof. They don't address identical identities, nor do they have identical remedies. So in order to prove her claim under 9414, for example, Ms. Heinrichs Katie must prove that Hennepin County failed to engage in an interactive process under that statute. The MHRA has no such requirement for an interactive process. In fact, there's a case just for the Supreme Court not too long ago that reiterated that there is no requirement under the MHRA to engage in interactive process. So it's a different sort of analysis that you need to get to. And I think the Williams case and the Wyrie case and the other sorts of the few cases that deal with this issue in our state courts have held that you can have similar parallel actions. They can come out of the same circumstances of fact. They just can't be identical. Now, with Williams, Williams is almost identical as you could get. Williams involved an employee who first filed a claim at the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. She's subsequently terminated. Then she sues in district court. She says, you violated my rights under MHR, and now you've terminated me because I sought my rights under MHRA. That's the reason for the whistleblower. Similarly, in the, I think it's the Miller case that opposing counsel cited, it's the same sort of thing. The whistleblower action is based upon the violation of the MHRA itself. So it's sort of wound into itself.
The predicate violation is MHRA.
Exactly.
And you're saying the predicate violation for your claim
is not the MHRA.
Is not the MHRA.
It's federal law and state law. Exactly.
It's the Pregnancy Act.
Yes.
What's the federal law?
The federal law would be the ADA.
Are you claiming?
We don't have a federal law claim in our district court action. And partly that's just due to the way those kind of claims work, where you first need to go to the EEOC and all of that and all of those mechanics. But in terms of making the whistleblower claim, to make a whistleblower claim in Minnesota, the employee has to just in good faith allege a violation of law, be it federal law or state law. And if they make that violation of the federal law, of state law, or what have you, then that's enough, and then if they are treated disparately, that's enough to trigger the whistleblower remedies.
Do you think that your complaint, and you've dropped your count three, right?
Correct.
So do you think your complaint with respect to counts one and two, does it assert that the plaintiff is disabled?
We don't think we need to do that, Your Honor.
Okay, so you're not resting on disability.
No, and that's one of the nice things about 9414, is it took all of that analysis out of it. Before, you know, we've had to deal with this, you know, treating pregnant women as disabled in order to seek the protections under federal law. And what the nice thing about 9414 is it gets rid of that. It simply says if an employee is pregnant, regardless if they're one day pregnant or going to give birth the next day, it doesn't matter how it's impacting their lives. We don't have to go through all of that analysis under the MHRA. Simply, if they ask for reasonable accommodations that are backed up by either a doctor or even their doula, then the employer must provide those unless they can provide that it's a hardship. So, no, we don't need to prove that she was disabled. And that's another one of the differences between the whistleblower claim in this case versus the whistleblower claim in Williams and in the Miller case.
Count three of your complaint did allege disability.
Count three did?
Yeah, paragraph 67. Defendant is engaged in unfair discriminatory practices by denying plaintiff a reasonable accommodation for her disability.
Okay. I don't think, and it's a notice pleading drafting. I think that in order to prove under 9414, we don't need to prove a disability.
I don't doubt that, but in the context of whether they're the same claim, part of your complaint was a claim of failure to accommodate a disability.
Okay.
I think implicitly includes a claim that there is a disability.
And I think that's a fair point. But I think it's the whistleblower claim is just more varied than the whistleblower claims in the Williams or the Miller case. So even if you conclude that it does include a claim that that would be similar to an MHRA claim, there are other claims with other burdens of proof within the whistleblower claim that would be different and not identical to a claim made under the MHRA. I'd like to address just briefly that, and then I think address the whistleblower part.
I have sort of a similar question about overlap. So to the extent that the allegation was failure to accommodate, I understand the difference in the interactive process, but if it's failure to accommodate and it was based, and there was, you know, assertion, because we're at a Rule 12, that the plaintiff was disabled, and then we run into the problem of overlap. Similarly, what about sex discrimination? if pregnancy is by definition under MHRA included within the definition of sex, and if you fire someone because she's pregnant, that can also be under the MHRA or is a discrimination on the basis of sex. What doesn't that also have implications then for the exclusivity provision? That should be brought under the MHRA. It's not, it can only be brought under the MHRA, not under the
under 9414.
9414.
Well, and I think that gets to our problem statutory interpretation. I'll try to be brief. The respondent's contention is that, you know, appellant's claims here violated, she's alleging the county violated 9414 in virtually every way that you can. And so if that's precluded by the MHRA, then there wouldn't be any claim that anybody could bring under 9414. It would preclude all claims, and that's not...
So part of this is maybe how the case would come in.
Correct.
If the case ended up only being fired, proof only fired because the plaintiff in this case was pregnant, that might overlap. But if there's other things, maybe it doesn't.
Right.
So Rule 12 might be premature to determine what the case actually looks like to determine the overlap.
Until the facts are determined. You're correct, Your Honor. I see my time is up.
Any other questions? Thank you. You have an additional time for rebuttal, Ms. Wolf.
Or is that switch?
Oh, it's sort of right at your waist a little bit. Okay. Do you see? If you look down under, just sort of
squeeze it.
There's a toggle switch.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wrong way.
Marshall, do you want to help Ms. Wolf?
Yes. May it please the court. My name is Beverly Wolf, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I'm here today representing respondent, the County of Hennepin. from the court's questions today, I'm just going to dive into answering the ones you've raised so far and any that you may have afterwards. With respect to the definitional section, I would look at that is the only...
Talking about 940.
Yes. 181.940. With respect to that, that is the statute clearly states it is the definition for all acts between 940 and 944, and that includes the pregnancy accommodation statute at 9414. And it is the definition that is provided. The one thing I would note, and I noted this in my supplemental, is that under section 9412 involving parental leave for school conferences, the legislature specifically excluded those employees in that section from the definition in subdivision 2. And so that demonstrates that the legislature, when it does not want to apply a definition to a specific statute within the PPLA, it has done so.
So, Ms. Wolf, though, I was reading the definition of employee also in conjunction with 9414 subdivision 4, which talks about an employer may not require an employee to take a leave or accept an accommodation. And that provision suggests to me that the legislature is looking, I always thought of leaves in this situation as often being kind of one type of accommodation.
Yes.
But here the legislature seems to suggest it's thinking about leaves differently than accommodations, which to me could say, look, this provision is about accommodations, which is different than leaves. And wouldn't that be at least another way of reasonably reading the statute, which means it's ambiguous and we look at legislative history?
Your Honor, I don't agree that it is ambiguous, but I think you could look at subdivision 4 in another way. If the heading to that says employee not required to take leave, And then it proceeds to say that an employer shall not require an employee to take a leave or accept an accommodation. And you could see the legislature as treating them as interchangeable, that leave is a form of accommodation, accommodation is a form of leave.
Wouldn't they have then said, or another accommodation?
Yes. Well, it may not be perfect language, but I think it is sufficient to make the legislature intent clear. Also, I would point out earlier in the in subdivision one, it specifically says that an employer is not required to provide a special make job or make duty for an employee who cannot be accommodated.
But those, of course, are fact questions for later, right?
Yes.
I mean, but we're not concerned with that question here.
No, and here the only, the facts are taken as alleged.
Right.
And so I'm saying taken as alleged in this case. She was presenting a series of accommodations that the employer made a determination that they could not reasonably accommodate in terms of her requested accommodations,
well,
and instead
really,
placed her on leave.
Your argument is that the employer didn't even have to try to accommodate, right? Because she's not an employee.
We still had obligations under the Minnesota Human Rights Act to provide accommodations.
But your argument is you had no obligations under 9414.
Yes, because 9414 is governed by 940, which has as a threshold issue that an employee must be an employee for 12 months.
What are your you just said that there were accommodations required under the Human Rights Act. That's only if she was disabled, right? There are no gender sex accommodations in the MHRA. It's only for disability.
That is correct, though. Okay. There are provisions against discriminating based on sex or pregnancy on the Human Rights Act. Here, though, her facts as alleged shows a disability. She's not able to drive as part of the thing. She can't do lifting over 10 pounds. She needs a break every hour to rest.
So even though it's a... I've just never seen a case where the employer comes in and argues that the complaint as a matter of law proves that a person is disabled. She hasn't said that in the factual part of it. I know count three references it, but that's dropped. And you can plead an alternative.
Well,
she said she had health conditions.
Not only that she had health conditions, but that to continue without these accommodations would put her life and her child's life at risk. And those are the facts that are alleged in the complaint. So assuming these facts are correct.
Can I go back for a moment to the definition of employee so I fully understand? You argue that the definition of employee under 940 is not ambiguous, mm-hmm. And that so an employee for who performs services for an employer from whom a leave is requested, presumably that means by the employee, mm-hmm. from whom a leave is requested, is your argument that asking for to sit down, asking for bathroom breaks, the other things that are accommodations, are leaves? Not that leave is an accommodation, but all accommodations are leaves?
I believe the argument I made below before the trial court was that by asking for these accommodations, given these functions of her job, she in effect was asking for a leave.
Why would the word leave in subdivision two, a leave, mm-hmm. unambiguously include a frequent restroom break, for example. That's mm-hmm. that just doesn't, especially, I mean, I'm also looking at, of course, the language that was already highlighted mm-hmm. earlier that says a leave or accommodation, suggesting yeah. difference. But even just in common English usage, I wouldn't think a food or water break or a lifting limit would be considered a leave under the common understanding of that term.
I think with respect to this, I was dealing more with her request not to go into homes for the children and not to drive.
Well, but the not going into homes, we wouldn't necessarily require a leave because, as I understand the facts, she had previously worked in a position for this employer that didn't involve going into homes.
That was a training position.
Presumably, she was doing something of value.
Oh, in that position, she was training and learning the job. And then she graduated to doing the job. and this was the aspect that these were essential functions of the job, and she was being asked to be excused from them.
But there again, aren't we getting outside of Rule 12 world and into factual question world?
I would disagree with Your Honor respectfully on that, because I think here is we're taking the facts as she alleges them, and we're not disputing the facts as she alleges them on this. And what we're talking about here is, with respect to the definition of employee, our main argument here is that the 12 months requires whether or not they're requesting a leave.
That she's Why? Not an employee at all. That's your argument.
She doesn't qualify as an employee.
Not an employee for purposes of 9414 for
yes.
any reason.
She does, right. And
see, that's a different.
If you hire an employee who's pregnant, mm-hmm. and that employee says, I would like to take more frequent bathroom breaks because I am told that this is something that pregnant women mm-hmm. often require, then an employer can say, too bad. You haven't worked here for 12 months. You cannot have more frequent bathroom breaks. Are you telling me that?
The employee doesn't qualify.
That doesn't make a lick of sense.
Why
would the legislature have enacted a statute saying that an employer may not claim undue hardship for these accommodations, specifically saying restroom breaks, but then have incorporated a definition that says, well, if you haven't worked there for 12 months, you just have to wet yourself?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I would say that the statute for 9414 only applies to employees who are here for 12 months or more. There may be nuances that may seem quirky if they're not covered, but the legislature modified the definition of employee when they passed the PPLA with respect to pregnancy accommodation, and they did not make any effort then to exclude the Accommodations Act from this definition.
If I may, Ms. Wolf, mm-hmm. perhaps turn your attention to the exclusivity argument with the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And let me just kind of give you my take on kind of 9414 and mm-hmm. just as opposed to the Human Rights Act, and I'd like you to kind of just tell me why you think I'm wrong. So I read this as being much broader in who it covers, because a lot of people who are pregnant may not qualify as disabled under the Human Rights Act, so you don't have to do that disability analysis. Broader in terms of there's certain things you can ask for and you just get without having to go through the undue hardship analysis. That would be broader. And I mean, those are just two examples of where this I would see as being much broader than the Human Rights Act. And with that, I would say, doesn't that tell us the Human Rights Act is not meant to be exclusive over something that is much broader, as opposed to perhaps the Whistleblower Act?
Your Honor, I believe you have to look at what is being factually alleged and what is covered under the Pregnancy Act versus what is covered under the Minnesota Human Rights Act.
Well, why do I have to look at the facts here to have to address the exclusivity argument? I mean, because isn't that a legal determination?
Well, it's the same thing with the Whistleblower Act. You have to look at what's being alleged as the basis of the act of retaliation or reprisal to determine if the exclusivity portion of the Human Rights Act governs over the Whistleblower Act with respect to that. So here you have to look at what's being alleged. Had this been a case where she simply, the one thing the Pregnancy Act provides that the Human Rights Act doesn't provide is that it specifically provides, without any medical documentation, restroom breaks, food breaks, water breaks, and lifting over 20 pounds. And had in this case, the appellant only asked for these, she would be exclusively covered under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act because this is not covered by the Minnesota Human Rights Act. But here in her allegations, she alleged that she had such severe medical complications that she needed accommodations that went beyond that.
But she also asked for some things that were simpler as well, as I read her request, but I'm sure you
can correct me if I'm wrong. Well, I don't really read her as being denied bathroom breaks or food breaks, et cetera, because it wasn't like she continued working and we kept telling her she couldn't do these things. This was basically the decision was made to put her out on leave. But after you get past those requirements that don't provide any medical documentation, then you are into accommodations, et cetera, that basically overlap the Minnesota Human Rights Act. They use the same language of reasonable accommodations. They also use, they follow Minnesota Human Rights case law in that we don't have to create a position for a person who's not able to do the job with their requested accommodations.
I understand that there may be overlap, just like if someone just got fired because the employer knew she was pregnant and discriminated and fired her because of that. You might say that's gender sex discrimination under the MHRA, if that's the entire universe of facts, and exclusivity provision might apply. Similarly, if it's I'm disabled. But these cases, the exclusivity cases, I don't know that they had to be, but they did seem to all come on summary judgment. So if this case were to proceed and the employee were not to put in any proof that she met the definition of disability, which is a specific definition informed by case law, instead just that she had health conditions because of her pregnancy, not that she thought that they impaired a major life function, you know, it was part of her job, not all of her job, et cetera. It seems premature, does it not, to say it overlaps entirely based on a type of accommodation requested, that she didn't want to do this. She doesn't allege that she wanted to stay home. She just didn't want to drive and do that element of her job. We don't know whether that's essential or not. It's like not pleaded. Doesn't it seem a little premature to decide that it's definitely disability discrimination and it is therefore within MHRA?
With all due respect, you take the facts as alleged, and she's basically alleging here that she was forced out on leave, and that is not that she was denied all these little breaks and all of that, that she was forced out on leave when she didn't want to go out on leave. Mm-hmm. And the Minnesota Human Rights Act does govern this. In fact, they have held in a very similar case that it was appropriate for the employer to put the person out on leave. And then there is also a specific provision in the Human Rights Act that allows as a defense to put somebody out, basically put someone out on leave if they would pose a danger to themselves or to others. So, and I see I'm out of time, so.
Why don't you just take a sentence or two to wrap up?
Okay. Basically, with respect to this, I would also note with respect to exclusivity, with respect to the whistleblower claim, counsel noted that she also had raised federal claims of the ADA in this case. But I think if you look at both Miller and you look at Williams, underlying issues there were sex discrimination or sexual harassment in one case, and both would have been violations of federal law, Title VII, and so they were applied in that case. With respect to the other aspect of the exclusivity...
Ms. Wolf, you've gone beyond your sentence or two.
I'm sorry. I thought you said a minute or two. But, thank you.
Thank you very much. Any rebuttal?
Thank you. Just a couple points to rebut some of the comments made by opposing counsel. The accommodations, and I know I'm arguing facts, but the accommodations were not severe. She requested bathroom breaks, not to drive when she's dizzy, and not to put herself in danger. You know, I would hope nobody would drive when they're dizzy or put themselves in danger unnecessarily. She wasn't working a highly dangerous job. She was a social worker.
And actually, the complaint itself, we are in Rule 12 world, right?
Correct.
The complaint itself isn't all that detailed on specifically what the accommodations were. It looks to me like she was starting to talk about accommodations, and then she claims, at least, that her supervisor said, I did this job pregnant, you can do it pregnant too, and that was kind of the end of the discussion.
Incorporated, Your Honor, in the complaint is Exhibit A, which has the note from the doctor, which sets forth those particular accommodations.
Which her requests, it seems, as we talk about it, may have gone beyond the specifics that are identified in that doctor's letter.
I don't think that's pled, but I could be incorrect. I believe what was pled was that she asked for the accommodations as set forth by her doctor, and then within 24 hours or so, she was placed on unpaid leave. Another argument the opposing counsel makes is regarding bathroom breaks and claiming that those should qualify as leave under 940. Under 9414, which does allow the employer to claim hardships for certain accommodations, it prevents an employer from claiming a hardship for bathroom breaks. I believe it's lifting over 20 pounds, bathroom breaks, and I think there's one other one where they absolutely by law cannot claim as a hardship. So if they can't claim it as a hardship, then I don't know how it would qualify as a leave under 940.
This first part of that sentence that talks about those things that cannot be claimed talks about a pregnant employee. So if respondent is right about the definition, that would not those provisions would not apply to employees who had not been employees for 12 months.
Right. The whole thing unravels if you have the 12-month requirement in there, right? But there's first the question of whether or not the request for accommodations counts as a or can be included in the definition as apply for a leave. And I just don't, it doesn't make any sense, especially when reading 9414, that asking for additional bathroom breaks couldn't be akin to leaving your employment for an extended period of time and coming back because of your medical conditions.
As Judge Smith asked, certainly lifting limitations aren't leave. There are plenty of people who work for long periods of time with lifting limitations. They're not on leave.
Correct. I just want to address a couple things just regarding how the interpretation I don't think passes muster constitutionally, whether we look at it under strict scrutiny or under the rational basis test. There's just not any real reason why an employee who works 365 days or more at her current employer should have rights that are different than somebody who has worked less than that. And I'll give you an example. If you have a woman who has worked for her current employer for 20 years and has an opportunity to take a different job with a different employer for increased pay, to one that's a higher position, one that can better herself, better her family, and she's thinking about being pregnant, she is going to be chilled from taking that position because she's going to be in a lesser position than, say, somebody who just entered the workforce and has worked somewhere for 365 days. And that sort of, the Constitution just doesn't allow that sort of disparate treatment between its citizens. It's unlike the case law that Respondents' Counsel cited where you have an employee you have a rule that says you have to retire within a certain period by the time you're 50 if you're a police officer. There is a public reason for wanting police officers to be young and nimble and strong, conceivably, and it only applies to police officers. So somebody who has mandatory retirement at 50 could go get a job virtually and doing anything else. Here, this statute applies to every single woman in Minnesota who is working for a qualified employer under the statute. And so regardless of whether you are working as a machine operator, a doctor, a judge, a social worker, it applies to you no matter what. And so in that way, I don't think it passes constitutional muster. And we would ask the court to reverse the district court's decision.
Under your interpretation, with respect to leave, if a pregnant employee seeks leave, mm-hmm. does that pregnant employee have to meet the tenure requirements?
That's an interesting question. If an employee is seeking leave, though, she wouldn't be seeking leave under 9414. 9414 doesn't have any provisions for leave other than the prohibition that an employer cannot force an employee to take an unpaid leave or to take an accommodation that they think is appropriate. So if there was an employee who was taking a leave of absence, be it for for pregnancy, be it for other health conditions, be it to take care of a sick family member, or I think there are leave provisions for child for school conferences, that sort of thing, that are in those other statutes that are in that bunch, then I think, yeah, it would be fine. Because again, that definition fits for all of those other statutes. It just doesn't fit for this one that the legislature stuck in 5 years ago.
Any other questions? Thank you. The matter was well briefed and well argued. We'll take it under advisement and issue a decision within 90 days. Thank you both so much. And that is the end of our oral calendar. We will be in recess.